From 90.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In the 60 years that have unfolded since the birth of the State of Israel in 1948, that part of the world has been constantly simmering and occasionally erupting into violence. One of the ongoing conflicts is the one between the Israelis and the Palestinians, which actually dates back to the birth of Israel. In 1948, nearly 800,000 people fled from their homes, their businesses, their schools, and orchards. Some have described this exodus as voluntary. The Palestinians refer to it as Al-Nakba, the catastrophe. One of those affected by Al-Nakba was the family of the current Palestinian ambassador to the United States. His family lost their West Jerusalem home in 1948, but the ambassador's response to that and the ongoing tensions between Israelis and Palestinians is diplomacy. But he also chides the United States about their role in all of this, suggesting that it is time for this nation to reconcile its power with its principles. Ambassador Afif Safieh was named head of the PLO mission to the United States after a 15-year stint as the Palestinian representative to the United Kingdom and to the Vatican. He's in Charlotte to speak tomorrow at Marriott Center City at 2 p.m. on understanding the Palestinian catastrophe, the root of the conflict. And he joins us for the hour under the auspices of UNC Charlotte's Striving for Peace Through Knowledge series. Mr. Ambassador, welcome to the program.
Good morning. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be with you this morning.
Before we talk about some of the things you'll be talking about tomorrow, can you tell me what the current state of relations, diplomatic relations, are between your country, the PLO, and the United States of America?
They have been warming up tremendously. You know, the official relations started in the early 90s after the breakthrough of the Madrid conference in 91, then the breakthrough of the Oslo back channel, the document of which was signed, as you remember, on the White House lawn on the 13th of September, 93. During the Clinton era, there was an intense interaction with between the American administration and the Palestinian leadership. There was a sort of period, an interim period in the early years of 2000, but now we are having a very intense warming up of relations. I personally believe in the sincerity of President Bush and Dr. Rice in wanting a breakthrough, a diplomatic achievement, and a success. And we are being constructive players in that approach. Unfortunately, we are witnessing what I call static diplomacy. The Israelis are not overexcited to move forward. I believe the Israeli leadership, for a variety of considerations, are in favor of the prolongation of the status quo, however unacceptable and uncomfortable it is. I can sense in Washington an irritation with the Israeli interlocutor because of the policy they are adopting, depriving America of the diplomatic success it seems to need in the Middle East. Yet nobody will complain in Washington because of domestic considerations. You are in the midst of a presidential campaign year. Right. Senator Moynihan had said in the past that an election year is rarely America's finest hour, and you are in the midst of a presidential campaign year. But let me tell you, having spent the last 2.5 years in America and constantly on the lecturing circuit from coast to coast, having visited many Ivy League universities, but also prestigious fora like the World Affairs Council in major cities, I was impressed by the big reservoir and the pool of goodwill in America vis-a-vis the issue of Palestine and the Palestinian people.
Does the PLO represent Palestine officially?
Yes, the PLO has been chosen by the Palestinians first, then by the Arab Summit meetings in 74. And, you know, Arab Summit meetings represent the Arab countries, 21 of them, from Morocco on the Atlantic to Oman, Muscat on the Indian Ocean. In 74, the Arab world recognized the PLO as the representative institution. Mm-hmm. And I always say the PLO is at the same time an idea and an institution. If thousands work in the institution, millions are the vehicles of the idea. For example, in my trips in America, I'm always meeting with the Palestinian community. And by the way, many Americans are unaware that you have here in America 400,000 Americans of Palestinian origin, 4 million of Arab origin. And for us, 400,000 is an important segment of our society. And by the way, one-fourth of them would be Palestinian Christians, and many are unaware that we have Christian Palestinians.
You're a Christian.
I am a Christian And often I'm asked, when did you convert to Christianity? And my answer is always to say, have you forgotten that Christ and the Christian message were born in our country and we exported it beyond that country? It didn't come to us with European colonialism, on the contrary. Mm-hmm. So we have a very vibrant, dynamic Palestinian-American community here, shouldering its responsibilities, working in better integrating itself.
The reason I asked about the official relationship between the PLO and the United States is I have a memorandum for the Secretary of State from the White House dated February the 11th of this year saying that, transmitting to Congress pursuant to Section 603 of a certain act regarding noncompliance by the Palestinian Liberation Organization and the Palestinian Authority with certain commitments, I, the President, hereby impose a sanction set out in 604A2 to downgrade in status of the PLO office in the United States. Do you know what this is about?
Which date are you citing?
February the 11th, 2008. And I'm not even sure what it means because I think in the next paragraph he rescinds the sanction.
On the contrary, every 6 months the President of the United States asks the Secretary of State to instruct Congress that he would like the waiver allowing the office to operate in Washington to remain.
I see.
Because he believes it corresponds to American national interests. So my presence and my operational activities from Washington are considered as part of the American national interest.
Okay.
And I'm not unhappy about that. I have met President Bush on a variety of occasions, be it in Washington or in New York during the opening sessions of the General Assembly of the UN. Dr. Rice I've seen on multiple occasions. We have, by the way, President Mahmoud Abbas visiting Washington on the 24th of April, meaning in a matter of 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So the relations are regular. And
let's talk about al-Nakba, because that's what you're here to talk about tomorrow, and you call it the root of the conflict, which has been going on now for 60 years. From the Palestinian point of view, when you talk about al-Nakba, or the catastrophe, as you call it, is the problem primarily that it took place, or is the problem the Israeli denial that it took place?
I think both.
Okay.
And I believe in the psychology of a conflict to be extremely important. And I always said in politics, denials are abominable. And I've always struggled against the denial of the Holocaust. We, the Palestinian people, sir, we have suffered of three successive denials. We have suffered the denial of our mere physical existence. Zionist ideology had a founding principle that Palestine was a country with no people, for a people with no country. Yet we were there, stubbornly there, rooted in the country for several millenniums, etc. So we suffered the denial of our mere existence. We have suffered until today the denial of our rights, and paradoxically, our country is now being colonized with acceleration. 60 years after the end of the decolonization period in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. But number three, sir, and it's extremely important, we have been denied our suffering and the recognition of our suffering. Our suffering was banalized and trivialized. Now, I, for one, never compare the Nakba to the Holocaust. I'm not in comparative martyrology. I believe each national ethnic tragedy stands on its own. I know of no way to measure pain or to quantify suffering. And I have often told Jewish audiences, if I were a Jew or a gypsy, the Holocaust would be the most atrocious event in the history of mankind. If I were a Native American, it would be the arrival of the early European settlers that resulted almost in my total extermination. If I were an Afro-American, it would be slavery in previous centuries, apartheid in last century. If I were an Armenian, it would be Turkish Ottoman massacres. And if I happened to be a Palestinian, it would be the Nakba catastrophe of 1948. Humanity, and your listeners are humanity, should consider all the above as unacceptable. And again, I repeat, I know of no way of measuring pain and quantifying suffering, but all I know, sir, is that we are not children of a lesser God. And even in the bleakest of moments, I kept confident that Palestine will one day resurrect. And as you know, and your listeners know, we in Jerusalem have had some previous experience in resurrection. Now, sir, we, among the victims of history, are one of rare victims of history whose tragedy was unrecognized. We became the Jews of the Israelis. We are the Jews of the Jews. Israel, its creation, was supposed to be an answer to the Jewish question in Europe. As a result, today we are the question of Palestine, still awaiting a convenient and equitable answer. Still awaiting.
You're the victim of European history.
We are the victims of the victims of European history. Okay. This is what blurred perceptions and deprived us of our legitimate share of sympathy, solidarity, and support.
One source that I read has described al-Nakba as an ethnic cleansing, an Israeli attempt to systematically expel the Palestinians from vast areas of the country to forcibly evict people. Is that how you would describe what happened in 1948?
Totally, sir. This is what happened. And by the way, to their credit, there are several Israeli historians who are called revisionist Israeli historians, whose work, scholarly work, coincides totally with Palestinian historians. And I could mention Avi Shlaim, Ilan Pape, and many others.
Well, these are the words of Ilan Pape.
And to tell you frankly, they are impeccable scholarship that they have produced, and under tremendous duress and blackmail and pressure from within their own society. Sir, what happened was the following. Britain, at the end of the First World War, promised Palestine to a Jewish national movement born in Europe. And that movement, to succeed, not only was it an imported ideology in Palestine, but it had to import its adherents from abroad into Palestine. And Zionism inflicted on Palestine a double human migration: the expulsion of the indigenous population and the importation of a substitute population to replace them. And that strategy was not recognized. On the contrary, Europe, coming out of the traumatic experience of the Second World War, applauded our misery and our tragedy instead of sympathizing and showing compassion. Unfortunately, in the dealing with our case, we have more passion than compassion.
I have about 30 seconds of why would they applaud that? I mean, we're talking about 800,000 people leaving their homes, the destruction of 531 villages by one count. Why would people applaud it and believe it to be a voluntary evacuation?
It was because in the perception of Western public opinion, it was connected to the tragedies of the Second World War and the atrocities of Nazi Germany, to which the Palestinians have nothing to do, and we were the ones who paid the price. And by the way, I always tell now today my Jewish and Israeli interlocutors, I tell them a Palestinian state is our right, but it is your moral duty, your ethical obligation, because you, better than anybody else around the world, know the human price individually and collectively that we have paid so that Israel can be created. Sir, Palestine had an obvious, overwhelming Arab majority, and the Arab majority was made of Muslims and Christians alike. So if you want to carve a new state that is as Jewish as England is English and France is French, and I'm quoting Zionist literature, you have to vacate that indigenous component. And let me tell you, sir, the war of 48 was done by violent terrorism by the Israelis. And I have read the memoirs of Menachem Begin. Menachem Begin committed several massacres, and he is one who said, without the massacre of Deir Yassin, Israel wouldn't have been born, and after Deir Yassin, our troops could advance like a hot knife in butter.
We have to take a break. Ambassador Afi Safia from the PLO mission to the United States, our guest on Charlotte Talks. Our program is made possible in part today by Donald Hack Diamonds, specializing in diamonds and precious gems with on-staff gemologists and designers. Donald Hack Diamonds, Sharon Road across from South Park Mall and at DonaldHack.com. And by the UPS stores of Charlotte, offering packaging and shipping solutions to businesses of all sizes with digital color printing and copying, mailboxes, and other services. Locations at the UPS store. com. On Monday at 9 on this program, we'll be talking about the intersection of science and religion. Many people don't believe that it can peacefully coexist. They see science as diminishing both man and God. Others don't have a problem with it. And one of those who does not have a problem with it is the director of the Vatican Observatory. He will join us. He's an internationally known astronomer. He will join us to talk about this Monday at 9.
The Friday News Roundup. General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker update Congress on the Iraq War. President Bush agrees to a pause in U.S. troop drawdowns. A top aide to candidate Clinton steps down. And American Airlines cancels hundreds of flights. The Diane Rehm Show, Friday.
From 10 to noon on 90.7 FM, WFAE. Tobias Wolff says there are no flawless novels, but a short story can be as perfect as a snowflake.
Stories have a way, for me anyway, of persisting in memory long after I've read them in ways that other forms don't.
Writer Tobias Wolff, next time on Bob Edwards Weekend from PRI. Sundays from 2 to 4 p.m. on 90.7 WFAE.
We're back at Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is the ambassador from the head of the PLO mission to the United States, Ambassador Afif Safieh, who is in town to talk tomorrow at 2 at Marriott Center City about many of the things that we're talking about today, understanding the Palestinian catastrophe, al-Nakba, the root of the conflict between Palestine and the Palestinian people and Israel and the Israelis. The United States and most of the rest of the Western world have seen this conflict for 60 years now through the eyes of the Israelis, or at least we have seemed to have taken their side in most of this. Why do you suppose that is?
For a variety of factors, but let me tell you, sir, that I have noticed that there is a change in American public opinion. And by the way, during the conflagration in Lebanon in 2006, all opinion polls that were conducted showed that over 60% of American public opinion wanted a more even-handed American foreign policy in the Middle East, which is extremely promising for us. Number two, sir, there is over 70% of American public opinion, which is today in favor of the two-state solution. Even within the Jewish-American community, sir, which is, by the way, not monolithic and not all rallying around AIPAC. On the contrary, today, many Jewish-American institutions are challenging AIPAC's pretension at the monopoly of political expression of the preferences of the American Jewish community. Also within the American Jewish community, over 70% would be in favor of the two-state solution. I believe the immediate identification between America's interest and Israel's interest is no more the case. On the contrary, a growing body of scholars in academia in America know that the unresolved nature of the Palestinian problem is what has made America unpopular in certain segments of the third world, the Arabo-Islamic world. They believe that we, the Palestinians, might be the key for America's credibility and even lovability. And I, for one, would like to see America the locomotive in finding the acceptable solution to Israel-Palestinian conflict. And let me tell you, sir, one of the messages that I have been trying to convey to officials and to public opinion is the following. We are not inviting America to sacrifice a traditional friend, Israel. We are offering America an additional friend, Palestine. I believe, sir, we live today in a sort of unipolar, monopolar international system with America as the only superpower. And I personally believe America is a fascinating society. You are a nation of nations. You are the world on miniature. Every possible country, culture, civilization, and continent in the world is represented within American ranks. And I believe, sir, in a unipolar world, non-alignment as a foreign policy choice is no more the choice of third world countries like in the 50s and the 60s when we suffered from superpower rivalry. I believe non-alignment today should be the American foreign policy. Why? For two reasons. When America today aligns itself on one belligerent actor in a regional conflict, not only does it alienate all the other players in that region unnecessarily, but it also alienates, offends, and even ghettoizes a domestic component of its own national social fabric. Believe you me, sir, it was not easy to be a Palestinian American, 400,000, an Arab American, 4 million, or a Muslim American because of this uncomfortable feeling that your country of adoption was being insensitive to the tragedies in your country of origin. I believe non-alignment should be America's foreign policy because it's the only remaining superpower. I believe that America should be comfortable with the principles of the United Nations of international law to be applied on. And to tell you frankly, I believe in international relations, in matters of war and peace, the international will should prevail on a national whim. And we would like to see America more involved, more assertively involved in conflict resolution in the Middle East.
Why did we, in your opinion, why did we ignore some of the evidence that obviously has come out in recent years with regard to the catastrophe, to use your words? Why did the United States ignore that? Why do we always seem to side with Israel.
To tell you frankly, I for one believe in the approach that speaks of the power of the pro-Israeli lobby. I believe that in Washington there is a lobby that has grown accustomed in using one muscle too many and going usually one pressure too far. Mm-hmm. I believe today, sir, that that lobby is no more in its golden era. And I believe that our cry for freedom out of captivity and bondage is being heard here in America. But for 60 years, sir, the debate was very unbalanced. We never had the chance to voice our narrative. There was a school of thought prevailing in Washington that spoke of identity of interest between Israel and America. Let me tell you, the lobby passed through a difficult moment with the collapse of the Soviet Union some 15 years ago because they lost the enemy. Before, they used to present themselves in America as the strategic asset to contain probable, possible Soviet expansionism. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, they lost the enemy, so they lost some of their utilitarian, functional raison d'être. Mm-hmm. And so then there was the fabrication of a whole ideological structure of a substitute at enemy, which was Islam, political Islam. And to tell you frankly, as a Christian Palestinian Christian Arab, but a universalist in depth, I personally believe that Islamophobia today is a very unwelcome phenomenon in Western societies. And I believe Islamophobia is the contemporary version of antisemitism.
But doesn't Islamophobia arise from some of the tactics used by radical Islam?
Sir, we fully condemn the radical strategies of fundamentalist Islamists.
I bring that up because you represent the PLO, and for years the PLO in this country, by the rank and file, and certainly by the government, because of our news reports, was seen as a terrorist organization. Yasser Arafat, the former PLO leader, was alternately described as a terrorist and the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, along with former Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. You worked with Yasser Arafat as a staff member at the PLO office in Beirut. You were in charge of European affairs there and also UN institutions. You have described him as the Palestinian De Gaulle. Talk about that for a second.
Well, I personally believe that Arafat was, in certain segments, a misunderstood Palestinian leader. He was the Palestinian De Gaulle, is that even in our demographic dispersion.
But De Gaulle was a difficult man.
history is made by not easy persons. You ask historians about Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill wasn't an easy phenomenon either, okay. But yet they made history. They came at the right time, at the right moment, with the right idea. Arafat has been the architect of Palestinian resurrection. We, after 48, the creation of Israel and the eviction of our society in the four corners of the world, were obliterated from the political geographic map in the Middle East, and we were scattered all over. Arafat started from Egypt on the Cairo University campuses, the reemergence of Palestine and the Palestinians as a player in the region. And he was extremely successful. By the middle of 65, his Fatah movement started appearing as a representative of Palestinian aspirations. In 69, he became the elected leader of the PLO. In certain segments, he was always character assassinated and misportrayed, but Arafat was our De Gaulle in the sense that he had to struggle against foes, but also against friends to maintain the rank of the Palestinians undiminished. He was always the incarnation of Palestinian national dignity. Now, let me tell you, for those segments who didn't like him, I would like them to look at Arafat also as the leader of Palestinian pragmatism. We are the people who bled, and we are the people who paid a price for the creation of Israel. Yet Arafat, because he belonged to principled pragmatism, is the one who led us to moderation and towards an inclination for accommodation. He's the one who led the political, internal, intellectual battle in favor of the acceptance of a two-state solution. And we became unreasonably reasonable since that moment. And it was thanks to Yasser Arafat that we moved from a position where we were demanding absolute justice, and he moved us towards accepting only possible justice. People never recognized the tremendous concession that Arafat has offered to those who chose to be our enemies.
So you have said, you just said that he was a victim of character assassination. Is, yeah. is this an example of the phrase or the saying that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter?
You said it, sir, and you spoke of accusation of terrorism, yet Nobel Peace Prize. That was not the unique case. By the way, Rabin and Peres, who got the Nobel Peace Prize, they were not angelic characters. Rabin is the one in 48 who engineered the eviction of the inhabitants of Ramleh and Lida, Lod, the Ben Gurion airport is on their land, etc. Kissinger, who was not an adorable angelic character, not innocent in the Vietnam War and the, its overspill into Cambodia and Laos, also apparently, if I remember well, got a Nobel Peace Prize. Menachem Begin, who was a wanted character during the British rule in Palestine for terrorist activity, who was involved in the killing of the UN envoy, Count Bernadotte of Swedish origin, also got a Nobel Peace Prize. And this is why, by the way, I find the choice of Nobel Peace Prize winners sometimes very ideologically motivated and of very questionable nature. Menachem Begin, I told you, sir, in his memoirs published in 1952, he says, if there hadn't been the massacre of Deir Yassin, which he was responsible of, there wouldn't have been Israel. And after the massacre of Deir Yassin, he says, and I'm quoting here, Zionist forces could advance like a hot knife in butter. Can you imagine the image? And that's the way it happened, because people were fleeing, and believe you me, not voluntarily. He was advised that the sentence was detrimental. So this is why I said it's in the edition of the book La Revolte, The Revolt of 1952, in subsequent editions, that sentence was scissored away because of its detrimental nature, because it's too truthful and too sincere and too glasnostically transparent. Sir, in Palestine, Israel, we were the victims of terrorism. I have constantly condemned violent acts against civilians committed from our side. So I have been consistent in that principled attitude. But let me tell you, I always tell Israeli interlocutors, whoever does not condemn Israeli practices, Israeli indiscriminate bombardment of civilians, is not morally qualified to have a respectable opinion on suicide bombings. And I keep telling Israeli interlocutors, a community that shows insensitivity vis-à-vis the suffering it inflicts should expect a reduction in the expression of sympathy for the suffering they have endured. So I invite Jews and Israelis to do some soul-searching and an admission and a recognition and hopefully a historical apology to the Palestinian people for what was inflicted on us in 48 will be extremely helpful for the reconciliation desirable tomorrow, sir.
Ambassador Afif Safia is the head of the PLO mission to the United States. If you'd like to join our conversation, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323. 800-603-WFAE. You can email us at charlottetalks@WFAE.org, or you can join us on our blog. Charlotte blogs on the front page of WFAE.org. We'll take a phone call. Don has been holding on for quite some time. Don, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Mr. Ambassador.
Good morning, sir.
I think, Mr. Ambassador, that the I can take a little bit of disagreement with you on your statement of the cause. In 1948, it's well documented, but the Arab countries came to invade Israel, Egypt, and several other countries, broadcast over the radios for the Arab people in Israel to leave, because it would block and hurt the invasion by the Arab countries. And lots of them left, and that was the start of the PLO. The Arabs that decided to stay are now participatory in the Jewish nation. I don't think that you have the right to say that you were chased out. The Arabs themselves invited you to leave to get out of the way of the onslaught of the Arab armies. As to the fact, sir, that you mentioned that Israel is killing innocent civilians, that, sir, is wrong for you to say. You sound very educated and very, and to a certain extent, very well informed. But as you know, the Arabs have been bombarding Israeli civilians with rockets over the over a whole bunch of years. I think, sir, the problem needs to be that the Arabs definitely have a lot of money. And Israel has a lot of technology. It's the only country there that has industry. I agree with you. It's about time that everybody buried the hatchet and decided how to live together. But I don't think it's good for you to say that you were chased out of Israel, sir. You weren't. You were asked to leave by the Arabs themselves so that...
Thank you for your intervention, sir, but I would like to comment with your permission on this point. By the way, in any war, there is always a campaign of disinformation, misinformation, or what some call agitprop. And one of the mythologies around this conflict is that there were on Arab radio stations calls for the Palestinians to leave their country, etc. There was an Irish scholar, and I give you the name, Erskine Childers, who in the early 60s made a research by monitoring and listening to all the recordings kept in the BBC. And the BBC, by the way, is the most prestigious media outfit with governmental British connections. He monitored and listened to every possible radio program in the region during the entire period of the war of 47-49 and found no trace of such calls, sir. So, sir, I think you are very sincere in what you said, but this idea is part of the mythology and part of the disinformation campaign that was irrigated. Number two, sir, we spoke of victims. I, for one, sir, I took a principled position, a universalistic position. I've been saying for years, any victim is one victim too many. And I really regret the death of any victim, whoever is the perpetrator, whoever is the casualty. But let me tell you, for example, 2 weeks ago, sir, we had 5-6 days of intense bombardments. On the Palestinian side in Gaza, we had 136 killed. On the Israeli side, 3 were killed. 2 military, 1 civilian. I took the position of saying all of those casualties are to be regretted. On the other side, there is too much of an Israelo-centered, a Judeo-centered approach where they only consider their victims to count as though our victims are nameless, fatherless, motherless, and voiceless and childrenless, etc. Let me tell you, sir, there are two possible approaches. Either a universalistic approach to consider all victims are victims too many, or a tribalistic approach of considering only my victims count and the others are well-deserved casualties. I have, sir, this universalistic approach, and I remind you of the figures. Last 2 weeks, we had 136 fatalities on our side, 3 on the Israeli side. So don't be too narrowly tribalistic. All casualties are too many.
Dan, thank you for your call. Is that why you say that you are unreasonably reasonable?
Sir, yes. Because as I told you, we were the victims of all that has happened. We had to be evicted so that Israel could be created with a Jewish majority, because we were the majority. So the majority became a minority through violent terrorism, and the minority was propelled to become a majority through military means. We had to be evicted for Israel to be created, unfortunately, and this is what has happened. When we adopted the two-state solution, we accepted historically that we would have 22% of what we think to have been legitimately ours. Is that not being unreasonably reasonable?
With that, we have to take a break. We'll come back to more of your calls for Ambassador Afif Safieh, the head of the PLO mission to the United States, in just a moment. Our program is made possible in part today by the U.S. National Whitewater Center. Run, bike, paddle, and climb on over 300 acres of woodlands, 15 minutes from Center City, Charlotte. A recreation facility for family outings, social events, or just a bite to eat. USNWC.org. And by Audi of Charlotte, featuring the 2008 A4 sedan and Avant wagon, available with 255 horsepower front track or quattro, Bluetooth, and more. On the web at AudiofCharlotte.com. It's the weekly news roundup. 2 hours of it today on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock because it's Friday, the national hour. First, a panel of journalists joins Diane to talk about General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker's update to Congress on the Iraq War, President Bush agreeing to a pause in U.S. troop drawdowns, and a top aide to candidate Clinton stepping down, among other things. And, of course, American Airlines canceling many of its flights, thousands of its flights, yesterday and the day before. That's in the first hour. In the 11 o'clock, it's the international hour. News that new outbreaks of violence in Iraq. President Bush reducing tours of duty for U.S. military personnel in Iraq and Afghanistan to 1 year. And China claiming that it foiled a terrorist plot targeting the upcoming Olympic Games. That's all upcoming later on this morning. If you'd like to join our program, now's the time. We'll get to Nancy, Michael, Denise, James, and others in just a second. 704-926-9323, 800-603-9323, or charlottetalks at WFAE.org. Back in 60 seconds.
Later today, Jackie Chan on the education of an action movie star. The early education.
We just get up 5 o'clock in the morning, the training, whatever teacher tell you to training. 1,000 punch, 1,000 kick.
How old were you?
6 and a half in that time.
Jackie Chan at 54, still Hong Kong's lovable tough guy, and our guest later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 FM, WFAE, your NPR news source.
The cap on spending for political ads has some groups seeing red, especially because those rules don't apply to individuals.
So why can't a few of us get together and pool a lot less than $1 million each into a pot so we can collectively match what the millionaires are able to say?
I'm Kai Rizdahl, free speech and pricey politics, next time on Marketplace from American Public Media.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 here on 90.7 FM WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Ambassador Afif Safieh is the head of the PLO mission to the United States. He's our guest this hour, in town to speak tomorrow at 2 in a free talk, open to the public, 2 p.m. At Marriott Center City on the third floor, Salon D. If you'd like more information on that, 704-604-7279, 604-7279. Let's go to Gastonia. Michael, welcome to the program. You're on WFAE.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to comment that this is certainly a program that a long time in coming, and I'm very glad that you're doing this. I actually wish that you would do perhaps even a month with the ambassador of programs. I just wanted to make a comment, and I will hang up. I agree with much of what the ambassador has said. I do believe that in the United States we do have a very filtered media that provides us with just a bit of information, but not the whole picture. And thank God for the Internet going to other news agencies, including the BBC. You get a very broader picture of what's going on. I would agree with the ambassador. There is a great number of civilian killings of Arabs that is not necessarily being focused on in the United States. The basis of the State of Israel is one that does have some roots in terrorism. When under British mandate, they did restrict the immigration of Jewish individuals to the area, and there were Jewish terrorist groups which fought against the British with bombs and guns and in similar fashion. Certainly something I feel like is lost here is that on the West Bank and Gaza, these areas have basically been under military occupation for roughly 60 years. And while I certainly by no means condone terrorism in any sort, certainly if you are under military occupation for that long without a sovereign state, I can at least understand why certain people might become more radical under that type of a yoke. Interestingly enough, too, just a couple more comments, and I will hang up. I find it interesting that anywhere between one-third to one-half of all foreign aid from the United States goes to one country, that country being Israel. And we're a very big country with a lot of cash going to one country of approximately 5 or 6 million people. My friends in college who are Jewish, and I have very close Jewish friends, some of them actually during the summer in college would go to serve in the Israeli army and then return for their fall classes. I know of no other situation where a citizen of the United States can go to another country and serve in their military and then come back. So I find it hard to see how the United States can be an objective and fair broker of peace in the area. And I'll hang up and just listen to your comments. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, sir, for your contributions. I see that you are knowledgeable in this, about the situation in Palestine. When I said we have become the Jews of the Israelis, I wasn't just being rhetorical. And you mentioned it, that this has been our daily life for the last 60 years. Sir, you're aware that for most Palestinians, from womb to tomb, from birth to death, they know nothing but military occupation. Whoever visits today, let's take the West Bank, will discover that it's a small geographic plot plagued with 600 unnecessary military checkpoints that are suffocating the economy and strangulating the society. I once made a study that we, Palestinian society, we are losing 8 million working hours a day in delays on those military checkpoints.
But those checkpoints are there for Israeli security.
for them to feel secure that somebody's not going to slip over and blow up a cafe.
Sir, those roadblocks are not between the pre-67 Israel and the occupied territory. They are deep, all of them, in Palestinian territory in order to protect the illegal settlements. And they are totally handicapping and paralyzing and strangulating the society and the economy. And their military value, by the way, is of extremely questionable nature. I believe the purpose is how to plunge us into economic decline so that many more Palestinians voluntarily will depart. Again, voluntary departure, but after so many other military and political and physical pressures. Gaza, you're not unaware, sir, is today totally under siege. Yes, Israel redeployed out of Gaza, but it's totally besieging Gaza, prohibiting the Palestinians of enjoying free access to neighboring countries like Egypt or access to the West Bank, etc. So Palestinian life has been unlivable. And I believe personally, sir, in spite of the blah, blah, blah about a peace process that up to now is going nowhere, because we are witnessing static diplomacy, we are losing time negotiating pre-negotiations, and we are static and stagnant there. In the meantime, settlement building in the West Bank is expanding exponentially, and I'm surprised at the absence of a more assertive American response. Each time Dr. Rice visits the region, she is welcomed by an Israeli pronouncement about housing units being added to the illegal settlements, while America's official position from 67 onwards is to say to the Israelis, those settlements are illegal. Yet America, unfortunately, is not having the sufficiently assertive policy vis-a-vis Israeli misbehavior on that important issue. And today we have 500,000 illegal settlers. And I don't know how many Americans are aware that many of those settlers are doing it for ideological, spiritual, religious reasons. Many pretend that the Bible is the title of property for them to expropriate and steal land in the West Bank. I've always said it's regretful that some have transformed God into a real estate agent. And I often say, those settlers, I grew up, sir, being taught that God created men and women after his own image. Those illegal Israeli settlers have unfortunately created a God after their own image, which is absolutely frightening. And each time I listen to them speak, I always say there is a need to proclaim the innocence of God.
Let's go to Nancy in Blowing Rock. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having this program, Mike. It helps to, I think, reset the balance. I quite agree that we had heard in the past so much of the Israeli side and nothing of the Palestinian side. There have been violence on both sides, and I think it was because people in the United States didn't know that there were about 750,000 Arabs living in what's called Palestine when the Israeli state was proclaimed in 1948. We thought it was empty land here. People just didn't know that people were killed and chased from their homes. There have been violence on both sides. I had the great opportunity of visiting the West Bank this past November. And what the ambassador says is perfectly true. The checkpoints and even the wall Israel is building are not just on the border. They are very deep into West Bank territory. That's supposedly the Palestinians' territory. And the settlements are continuing in spite of the fact that the government says that they will stop settlements, that they're not going to build new ones. They're expanding the existing ones. It was really an eye-opener to me. I had no idea that Israel was taking as much of the Palestinian land in the West Bank as it is. While negotiations are going on, they are still taking land. I would like to say that I'm a very strong supporter of Israel. I feel that Israel has the right to exist, must exist, and I would never question that. However, I think the Palestinians are also human beings, and they're farmers and they're tradespeople, and they need to have a sustainable homeland of their own. And I'm glad that their story is being heard.
Okay.
We visited lots of groups. We visited farmers all over the West Bank. We visited in Jerusalem Israeli groups working for peace, Palestinian groups working for peace, and then these wonderful groups that are a combination of Israelis and Palestinians, like the Bereaved Parents Circle, and I can't right now, oh, Combatants for Peace. They are, in spite of all odds, working for peace. But I think the expansion of Israel into the West Bank just must be stopped. It's immoral.
Nancy, thank you very much for your call.
Ma'am, I believe personally that you reflect the overwhelming majority of American public opinion. Today, it's no more the either-or situation. People are not offered the choice of being pro-Israelis or pro-Palestinians. As I said earlier, ma'am, we are not inviting America to sacrifice a traditional friend, Israel. We are offering America an additional friend, Palestine. Today, it's not anymore either-or. And I'm sure we have many friends in common on both sides of the frontier. You mentioned the expansion of Israel into the West Bank. I personally believe America is committed to Israel's security, yet America is not committed to Israel's expansion. In Israel, there is a vibrant debate about the wisdom, the sagacity of keeping the hilltops of the West Bank. But here in America, what is America's interest in Israel keeping the hilltops of the West Bank? I think none. And I believe we should be encouraging a more open debate here in America. And I still remember how all hell broke loose when Carter produced his book titled Apartheid or Peace, and I believe personally Carter is one of the most decent, ethical politicians around the world. I have great respect for the person, and I was really saddened by the character assassination attempts against Carter when his book was published. Yet I was happy at the American response about the book because it became a bestseller and helped being an eye-opener. But as I said earlier, ma'am, it's no more either or. I invite America to be pro-Palestinian and pro-Israeli at the same time and to become aware that Israel's best interest and Israel's security lies and resides in the birth of a Palestinian state besides it.
Scott in Charlotte writes, the ambassador seems unreasonably reasonable. I'd like to know what the Palestinians have done wrong in the ambassador's view.
You know, since we are not the major player, because we are the oppressed and the dispersed and the occupied, even some of our blunders were not of as great significance and importance as blunders or injustices committed by the other side. I have often floated ideas of my own, and I, for one, I'm known that I'm in favor of us converting our national struggle into popular nonviolence. I believe in the power of nonviolence. Unfortunately, we as a society, we are not offered the luxury of a choice between resistance and non-resistance. We are offered the choice of the modality of expression of resistance.
So to answer Scott's question, are you saying that perhaps your cause was hurt by the violent activities that have preceded this conversation?
I personally believe we have an enlightened national interest in converting all of us, Hamas, Fateh, all components of society, however big the wound and the scar, to convert towards popular nonviolence. I believe that, one, it will allow us to mobilize 100% of our society in that struggle. It will allow a big segment of Israelis to embrace that struggle.
You just said the wound and the scar, and this is the sticking point, that it seems to me, that in the Middle East at large, there are these long, decades, century-long memories of injustice and being done wrong by one side or the other that we just can't seem to get beyond. How do you get beyond? How do you get to the next step? How do you get Israel to trust you enough to take down these barriers and to allow the establishment of a Palestinian state and still feel safe about their own existence?
Sir, I believe that you should have had another component in the question. How would you make the Palestinians feel confident with the Israelis and trust them?
That's fine.
Because all we know of Israeli society are the army and the settlers at checkpoints harassing, oppressing, and humiliating our society. Sir, I believe in peace. I believe in reconciliation. And I personally believe that if we are left to ourselves, Israelis and Palestinians, we will not achieve the acceptable, desirable peace. So I believe in third-party role and in the indispensable nature of that third-party role. to tell you very frankly, the major flaw of the previous attempts at peacemaking was the fact that we were left to sort it out between ourselves. And since we are speaking of two asymmetrical players, up to now the Israelis were constantly tempted to dictate conditions on the Palestinians and decide the ceiling of the possible and the permissible. I always believe, sir, that in matters of war and peace in international affairs, the international will should prevail on a national whim. I hope one day that through the quartet, you know, is the diplomatic construction that groups America, the European Union, Russia, and the UN to represent everybody else. The quartet would tell the local actors, we and the Israelis, what the world expects from us. I promise you that we will be constructively involved. Mm-hmm. I hope the other side will be equally as disciplined. And I personally believe, sir, that a territory that was occupied in 6 days in 67 can also be evacuated if there is a political will in 6 days, so that the Israelis can rest on the 7th and we can engage enfin, finally, in this fascinating journey of nation building and economic recovery. Mm-hmm. But we need a third party involvement, and I believe that American role is totally indispensable.
We have about a minute left. You have said that American Jews have both the moral duty and the strategic interest to help in the creation of a prosperous Palestinian state. What is the role of American Palestinians?
Sir, they are now playing an expanding role. And America is fascinating because in America one can keep one's identity yet work on furthering one's integration. They are increasingly now involved in the national debate on a local level. We're learning the ropes. While others have learned to run, our community here is learning to walk. It's much more recent. It was much more fragile and vulnerable. But today they are constructively involved in the national debates on a local level. They will have soon institutions of a national caliber. I believe their role in raising awareness, in lobbying Capitol Hill and the future administrations is of tremendous importance. I always say we became a global tribe. You run into Palestinians from Scandinavia to Pennsylvania to California to Australia. That's the symptom of our wound and our tragedy, the fact that we are so dispersed. But it can be the future source of our political empowerment. Do you know, for example, sir, that the Prime Minister...
I have to stop you. We're out of time.
It was a pleasure being with you, sir.
Mr. Ambassador, Ambassador Afif Safia speaks tomorrow at 2 at Marriott Center City. Thank you for being here. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our senior producer is Wendy Herkey. The associate producer is Tim Ross. Aaron Sutton is our research assistant, and our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, go to WFAE.org.
And our program is made possible in part today by NC Green Power, allowing residents and businesses to invest in renewable energy generation through tax-deductible contributions on their electric bills. Information at NC greenpower.org and by Huntington Learning Center, where your child can learn for children who struggle with homework, can't keep up with assignments, or just want to get ahead. Huntington Learning Center, 4 locations in the Charlotte area, 1-800-CAN-LEARN.
I'm Marco Werman. Breakdancing has gone global. You can see b-boys all over Europe and Asia, breaking in professional competitions, even in Buddhist temples.
They've included dance as a means of promoting the religion to younger people. And to see the monks just completely mesmerized by this dance form was quite an experience.
Planet B-Boy, next time on The World.
Join us tonight at 7 here on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Mike Collins. The battle between religion and science has been long and storied. Today, there is a disagreement over stem cell research and the theory of evolution. Earlier battles have been fought over whether or not the Earth revolved around the sun. Some feel that the relationship between science and religion is incompatible, while others feel quite comfortable blending the two. We'll get the perspective of the director of the Vatican Observatory when Charlotte Talks Monday at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. Partly sunny in upper 70s today, going down to the lower 60s tonight. Thunderstorms in the morning tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers through the day, lower 70s, and then cooling off considerably through the weekend. WFAE Charlotte, WFHE Hickory, your NPR news source. 10 o'clock. From